From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Sometimes big changes sneak up on us. Many adults today spent hours and hours playing outdoors as kids. In the country or suburb or city park, we were out in nature, or at least outdoors. Suddenly, it's the 21st century, and there's been a mass migration of children indoors. Their contact with the world that made us, by one study, now amounts to less than 7 minutes a day. Researchers and educators say we need to put our children back outdoors, that their health, mental and physical, depends on it. And it's not that hard, says my guest today. This hour on Point, raising the wild child, why we should, and how we can. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you remember playing, roaming in the woods, across lawns, through the park till dark, your parents hollering to call you home? How do we get our kids back out and into nature now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York City is Scott Sampson, dinosaur paleontologist and chief curator at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, host of the Emmy-nominated PBS Kids series Dinosaur Train. He's out with a new book, How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. It's a great read. It doesn't just identify a problem. It tells you how you can fix it. For an excerpt and links to nature apps you can use with your kids, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Scott, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom. Pleasure to be on.
You've got a headline here in the book, Life Under House Arrest. Make the case, because I think people may be slapping their heads and saying, really? 4 to 7 minutes a day outdoors? Really? Our kids live under effective house arrest now? What does that look like? Make the case.
Yeah, well, I'm not criticizing parents. I'm basically citing statistics that the average child today spends, as you said, 4 to 7 minutes outdoors a day, at least minutes, and 7 to 10 hours staring at screens. That outdoor time is 90% less than most of their parents had. So in one generation, we flipped this around. And you could say on the face of it, well, who cares? So now we're engaged more with technology. But there was a U.S. Surgeon General a few years ago who said that this generation of kids may be the first to have a life expectancy shorter than that of their parents. Obesity, diabetes, attention deficit disorder, depression, all of these conditions are skyrocketing in the generation today of kids. And nature's no panacea, but it's a great step in the right direction to get kids more active and engaged.
What is it that has pushed or pulled or both our kids indoors and away from nature?
Yeah, there's been a number of factors. One is the fear factor. That is that thanks in large part to the media hyping all of the incidences of children being abducted by strangers, there is this fear that our kids will be abducted, even though the odds of this happening are no greater today than in 1950 or 1960.
When it was leave it to beaver all over the place.
And most kids, most of us kids were just running around outside free at night, and we survived to the present day. There's also the busy factor that we overschedule kids today. They have more homework. They have, you know, after-school sports and piano lessons and all these things. So they just don't have time to play outside. And then there's the lure, the siren call of technology, all these screens pulling us in. And we know that these technologies are addictive. And you put all these things together, and it really means that, you know, the greatest exercise many kids are getting is with their thumbs.
Why does it matter?
It matters because it impacts the health of kids and the health of the places that we live. So first, with the health of kids, I mentioned some of these physical conditions that are rampant in kids. That's on the day-to-day level. It also matters because of the we're impoverishing the growth of children if we don't give them that outdoor connection. We know that unstructured play in the outdoors is critical for kids growing up, for their brains, for their bodies. It helps with motor skills, agility, balance, etc. It helps with their brain power, their creativity, their imagination, their problem solving. all of these different elements. Even bullying tends to be reduced in natural settings. So that's with the health of kids. With the health of the places we live, if you go out and ask 100 scientists today, what are the most pressing problems of our time, you're going to hear answers like climate change, species extinctions, habitat destruction. My argument is you can't solve those issues unless people care about where they live. And why would they ever care if they're just looking at screens? That screen looks the same in Timbuktu as it does in Denver, Colorado, or in New York City. So we need to engage people with where they live so they understand it and care about it if we're going to become sustainable as well.
Scott Sampson writes in Raising How to Raise a Wild Child. He says, first, the current disconnect between kids and nature threatens the health of children. A childhood lived almost entirely indoors, immersed in technology, is an impoverished childhood, as you say, with numerous negative impacts on growth, physical, mental, and emotional. Second, the current trend toward denaturing childhood also threatens the places we live, and perhaps even the future of humanity. He says, we have about one generation, some say less, to make profound changes and set ourselves on a sustainable course. After that, well, nature, as they say, bats last. Scott Sampson there writing in How to Raise a Wild Child. So is it as easy as shooing them out the door?
Well, maybe not quite that easy, but it almost is that easy. It's about establishing new habits. I mean, anything like this, that it's a cultural change, involves establishing new habits. We need to start thinking about getting kids outdoors the way we think about literacy. We read to our kids at night pretty religiously, at least a lot of us, because we recognize the fact that language skills are critical for life. Well, in the same way, the growing body of evidence, much of it only published in the last 10 to 15 years, suggests that this outdoor time is equally critical for the health of children. So one way to do it is, on my website, raiseawildchild.com, associated with the book, we invite people to take the 30x3 nature challenge. Just get your kids outdoors for 30 minutes, 3 times a week, and see what happens. Don't believe me. Go check it out and see how your kids respond to that. We know that kids will relax more, that their stress levels will go down. They're better able to concentrate and problem solve, the kinds of things you need to do for homework. So give kids that opportunity and just see what happens. It's a matter of noticing nature, engaging with it, literally hands-on. Forget this stay-on-the-trail stuff. Get off the trail once in a while. Let the kids throw rocks and climb trees and stuff. And then promote that sense of wonder. And as a nature mentor, an adult, the key here is to not be there with all the answers. That's the temptation. But you don't need to be an expert. In fact, you don't need to know any answers. It's much more important to ask questions, because questions are the things that provoke curiosity and wonder. If you get kids outside and you ask them questions about it when they come in, you can turn what was potentially just a mundane experience into something that they may remember for a lifetime.
You say the planet depends on it, but you also say that the children's health depends on it. The physical part of that, the obesity problem, which we know so well and see all over, I think we get that. I mean, if you're not running around, you're not exercising your body. But what claims are you making exactly about mental health? What problems are you tying into too little exposure to nature? I mean, you start getting into depression, ADHD. Take us down your list and tell us what you've learned.
Sure. There's a growing research, and once again, a lot more research needs to be done, and it's just really getting going. The notion of psychology has always been limited to the city, and psychologists traditionally haven't gone beyond the city limits because they're mostly thinking about the human mind. But recently, whole fields of psychology, eco-psychology, environmental psychology, evolutionary psychology have developed, and as we think about the impacts of the natural world on people, and what we're finding is exposing kids and adults to the natural world can have real health benefits. The Japanese have known this for centuries. They have a habit that some businesses will send their employees off to do forest bathing, it's called. Just spending time in a forest without technology, breathing. We know that this lowers cortisol levels, the stress hormone. We know that people relax, heart rates go down, blood pressure goes down. So that's just the immediate physiological effects. We also know from a lot of studies that kids need unstructured free play. And by that I mean the kind of play where parents are on the periphery, or if they're involved, the kids are driving the games. So lots of loose parts, which is what you find in nature, sticks, rocks, acorns, whatever.
But are you saying, I want to get to the claim here, are you saying that the absence of that, there's a straight line connection to attention deficit disorder, which we have so much of in this country now?
Yes. I think it's on the order of 17% of American kids are on drugs for attention deficit disorder, which, of course, is a dramatic increase in the past generation. And nature on its own isn't going to solve this, but we do know that time out in nature reduces the symptoms of attention deficit disorder. So it can help kids relax. And I've heard from many, many kids, and when I was doing the interviews for this book, I talked to a number of people who said, until we got our kids outside, we couldn't deal with this attention deficit. But now that we get them outside regularly, they're far more relaxed. They're far more able to concentrate in school, etc. So yeah, it can have a big effect.
Are parents resistant to what you're describing here?
What's really interesting is that parents aren't resistant. I don't think I have yet to hear a parent come up to me and say, you know, I don't think my kids need to be outside. There are studies that show that the vast majority of parents recognize that kids need more free time outside, but they're just not getting it. So to me, this suggests that our lives are so busy that we're just not finding ways to allow kids to do this. And so one of my goals with this book is just to show how dead easy it is, that it's just a matter of getting out there, noticing nature. If you're driving the kids to school, you can comment on clouds or trees or birds. When you step outside in the morning, just pause. You can give yourself 10 seconds. And if you value nature, guess what? Your kids will too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Five kids right there playing indoors. You can hear them shouting over their video game indoors. We're talking this hour about children and nature, how they drifted apart, how to get them back together in our age of inside all the time childhood. Does it matter? Well, at the summit of Clinicians for Healthcare a couple of years back, Surgeon General Richard Carmona sounded the alarm, saying the way we are bringing up our children means they may not live as long or as well as us, their parents.
We are raising a generation of youngsters who are overweight, obese, and can be saddled with more disease than we could ever imagine. Where my CDC epidemiologist told me, Surgeon General Carmona, this could be the first generation of children that lives less than its parents in the history of this nation.
Is there another way? Yes, there is. Here's a gang of about six toddlers running around the woods, parents back a ways with their video cameras, but kids out there anyways. They chase each other through the trees. That's the sound I guess Scott Sampson may be looking for. He's author of the new book, How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, Scott, but your book made me think about my own childhood, maybe yours. I mean, granted, I grew up on a farm, but I mean, just out in it all the time on the Kickapoo Creek and running through wild terrain and home in the evening full of brambles and tadpole juice and, you know, just and the way imaginations just run wild in that setting, like no other setting I can quite think of. And no one thought twice about it. It was just the way it was. I take it from your book, your own childhood had a lot of that experience in it as well. And a parent who really steered you there.
Yeah. I was very fortunate. I grew up on the west side of Vancouver, British Columbia, and I had a forest about a block and a half away. And I mean, I was like you. I was, you know, kicked outside every night after school. There was hardly any homework, especially in elementary school, for goodness sake. And then, I mean, some of my fondest memories are playing things like kick the can and hiding behind the bushes and hoping you don't get spotted and then making that sprint to kick the can and that rush when you actually get there first. I mean, you just can't replace that with technology. And to think that kids are growing up without that is pretty tragic. Then you think about autonomy. Think about the freedom that you had as a kid.
Oh, my gosh.
And how a lot of kids today don't have an unsupervised moment before they get to middle school. I mean, that's pretty staggering thought. And kids need that kind of autonomy, especially once they reach 6 years old, 7 years old. They're looking to break away. That's the age when kids used to go and build forts in the woods away from their parents and things like that. And without those kinds of experiences, what are we losing and what are our kids losing? There's a lot of talk today that we're raising kids that are dependent on grown-ups, that don't know how to find their way in the world, that lack confidence and self-esteem. And is it because we're not giving them enough autonomy?
This goes deep. This goes, I think, to the soul of a child. Let's go to our listeners. Lindsay in Edmond, Oklahoma. Lindsay, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me get on.
Yeah.
Okay, so I live in Oklahoma. I'm 26 years old, grew up on a farm, and every day from the moment school got out until 9 p.m., I was outside with my animals. I showed livestock and 4-H and FFA, and I'm married, and we don't have any children right now, but hearing the story and hearing that kids are only being outdoors for 10 minutes, less than 10 minutes, is absolutely terrifying to me.
It's shocking. What did you raise for 4-H, FFA, Lindsay?
I showed cattle, sheep, and pigs, but cattle was by far my favorite.
Boy, you're right in my wheelhouse there. So you're 26. do children cross your mind? You think you'll have them? And what will you do? I mean, if the norm has now become indoors all the time, how do you deal with that?
Well, I will hopefully be having children probably in 3 to 4 years. And living in the city is difficult. I'm not going to lie. I never thought I would get away from the farm. And my husband and I both grew up with an agriculture background. And I think it's something that we value, nature and everything. So we'll just have to find ways to get our children outdoors. And obviously 4-H, FFA, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, youth organizations like that that give them those life skills and understanding how important nature is.
I really appreciate your call, Lindsay, and I wish you good luck with that. Scott Sampson, begin to give us some of your strategies, rural, suburban, urban, for that matter, how to get it done.
Yeah, well, Lindsay's story is a pretty typical one in some respects. People who grew up on a farm often have that deep connection with nature. And 100 years ago, most of us had access to or associated with farming in some respect. And of course, that number has been reduced to a tiny fraction today. The key about nature connection is that it does not involve heading out into the national parks on a regular basis. It's great if we can do that, but the odds are we're only going to be able to do that 2-3 times a year at most. Real nature connection happens close to home. It's that everyday abundant exposure to the natural world. It's plants in the backyard. It's growing a garden. It's the local park. And in order to get nature connection, we need two aspects. We need access and we need engagement. So there are urban areas that don't have much nature, but it would be easy to add it. It turns out if you just add native plants, those native plants will attract native insects, which attract native birds and other animals. So we could rewild our cities simply by planting native plants in backyards and schoolyards and courtyards and parks and all these different things. And then if we could engage kids through schooling, have outdoor classrooms, send kids out into the backyard. I mean, heck, put the kids out in the backyard to do their homework, for goodness sake. They don't have to be indoors all the time. Then we'll be promoting that daily exposure to the natural world.
Randy in Peoria, Illinois. Randy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Hi. Like you, I grew up Kickapoo occasionally, mostly learned to swim in the Mackinac River.
Yeah, I know it well, yeah.
when the parents weren't looking, dive off the railroad bridge.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is what I've noticed. 65 now, raised a big family, largely living in two communities. One, I wondered why, is the culture where the kids are out there with a little bit of light late at night, and why is this? And when I back off and look, accidentally, one community, I can take you by the hand and show you, from the 1850s forward, for some reason, required every piece of property to have a sidewalk. And they all connect, and you don't have to walk in the street. The next community, upper middle class, whatever, just never gave leadership to that, which tends to be common. And the one sidewalk will stop into grass. There isn't any a lot, and so kids can't connect. I know I don't offer a simplistic answer, but boy, the difference in the two communities, as I looked at the two, I will choose a community to live in that has sidewalks.
Randy, I really appreciate your call, and thanks for bringing the Mackinac to mind. Scott, it can be just as simple as that, the way we structure our community. If there's no sidewalk, you've got a big message right there. This isn't meant for walking around, and this is meant for getting in the car and going to the supermarket or to soccer practice.
Yeah, and this is particularly true of the suburbs, as Randy points out. Suburbs are not built for walking. They're built for driving, at least traditionally. And if we look at our friends in Europe, they design their communities very different often, where walkability is the prime factor that they're building around. So we could do the same thing here. If we're going to connect people with nature, it has to be done not just from the bottom up with families getting kids outdoors and teachers doing the same. It also has to have a top-down element with government saying, okay, we're going to collaborate with local communities and give them access to nature. So that's equally important. Randy's exactly right.
Another one right here, Jamie in Columbia, South Carolina. Jamie, you're on.
Hi. My point that I want to make is that it seems like lately parents that have been allowing their kids to go to the park for the day have been getting arrested because the parents aren't around for whatever reason.
Yes.
But I feel like if you're a mile away, there's really, I mean, let the kid walk home. It's fine. Give him a key.
I'm right there. But like you, Jamie, I've seen those headlines, and you must have as well, Scott. Maryland parents investigated for letting kids walk alone. You know, free-range parenting is like an insult to proper parenting. Would you call 911 on another parent? I mean, I think I walked a mile home from kindergarten alone. But today, if people follow your advice, they're going to end up with the police on their front step.
Yeah, I was like you. I also walked a long way home from kindergarten by myself. And you're exactly right. There was the recent case in Maryland and others where parents have been called up by the law and said, no, that this is abandonment of your children and all these things. And it's another reason why parents don't want to let their kids out. Even if they believe in it, they don't want to be looked down on by neighbors, let alone be arrested for it. So this is where getting communities to come together and say, no, we're not going to stand for this. Getting parents to help kids get out in the morning. Maybe the parents will help walk them to school and raise awareness of these things. Cultural change of this magnitude will not happen overnight. It took a generation to get us to where we are now from where we were, and it's going to take some time to get us back where we need to be.
We've got a lot to dig on into here. Of course, school matters too, where we send our kids, how they treat outdoors. Right now, Aaron Kenny joins us from Vashon Island, Washington. This is outside Seattle, across a little water there. She's co-founder and director of the Cedar Song Nature School, author of Forest Kindergartens, The Cedar Song Way. This is a school, well, where the preschool, where the children spend, Erin, you tell us, a lot or all the time outdoors?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Yes, at our all-outdoor year-round preschool for 2 to 6-year-olds, the children are out up to 5 hours a day, no matter what the weather. And one of the main reasons that I developed this program was 8 years ago was because I was really alarmed at the trend of today's children's lack of outdoor time. And when I'm talking about the benefits of outdoor time, as Scott is, I'm talking about a specific type of outdoor time. It's an unstructured, free time in nature. So it's different than organized sports or organized activities or even environmental classes outdoors. It's about something that's been lost in childhood that we, who, like me, I grew up in the 60s, just took for granted as a natural part of childhood, that extended outdoor time that was unsupervised and unstructured and allowed children to really go deeply into their own creativity and imagination and connect with nature in a really authentic way through our free play.
So tell us, Erin, I mean, if we've seen it, we know, but you see it with a lot of kids and every day. Describe what happens when you put that child in nature as opposed to in an indoor kindergarten room or preschool room? What unfolds?
Sure. Well, one of the first things that people think, of course, when children are outdoors is that they're just running amok and going crazy. And part of it is that because children spend so much time indoors that they really have a lot of active energy that they need to release. And this is good for children. This is something that children are supposed to do. And a lot of people have been talking about that ADHD is actually a symptom of the lack of outdoor time that today's children have. And rather than medicating these children, we should be getting them outdoors more. So, of course, as Scott mentioned, you do see a lot of the physical benefits, the stronger immune system, stronger bodies. But one of the most interesting things that I've noticed is how it how being in nature, free play in nature, reduces stress in children. Today's preschool children are just continuously in a state of transition. They have 30 minutes to do this and then 10 minutes to do this, and then we got to get ready to go do the other thing. And so there is no real free play in nature built into their day. And as Scott said, it'd be a great strategy for parents to not just kick their children outside, but to go outside with their children. And it helps develop meaningful relationships with your children, to spend time in nature with them. So one of the things we definitely see is this sense of relaxation, almost a therapeutic value to nature immersion time. The other thing that we see is increased focus and concentration, and there have been studies with ADHD children that show that spending time in nature, engaged in free play, leads to a greater ability to focus and concentrate when they go back indoors to do their lessons.
Aaron, stand by there on Vashon Island in Washington State, outside Seattle. David is calling from Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just before I make my point, I wanted to mention I'm 53 and I grew up in the Hudson Valley of New York.
Yeah.
And had relatives on Long Island, and my family lived on the border of a farmland, of a farm in farming community. And when the relatives used to come up, we'd get out the walkie-talkies and we would play some version of a search game in acres and acres of cornfields.
Oh, boy. Sounds
and,
great.
I still don't have a cell phone to this day, and I tell people sometimes when they ask, I outgrew the walkie-talkies a long time ago.
What are you thinking now, David?
I'm thinking about sunburn and how many people don't send their children out much or as much as they would like to because they're concerned about things like sunburn. And I read a book a number of years ago by a man named John Ott, and I was wondering if your guest had ever come across this, or your first guest, that is. And it's called Health and Light, and he was the time-lapse photographer for much of the wonderful world of Disney opening scenes where you saw plants going from seeds to fruit.
Yeah.
And he makes such a compelling case in there, and he relays a lot of the difficulties that he had in photographing those time-lapsed sequences, especially apples. Sometimes it took a whole year. And he found that, for example, plexiglass made a big difference. So when your guest was talking about attention deficit disorder, it might not only be that there's a stress release, but is there something in full spectrum light, for example, that we need, you know, for a certain amount of the day? So I'll leave it there and take the answer off air.
David, I appreciate your call. Scott Sampson, what do you say to the light versus sun damage awareness?
Well, as somebody who's pretty pasty white with my European origin, I know that you definitely need to be very concerned about covering up and putting on sunscreen. I don't know about full spectrum light versus partial spectrum as a health benefit. I do know that, for example, the Japanese and their forest things have argued that the trees release chemicals that, if we inhale, may have health benefits that are positive. But that's an interesting one about full-spectrum light. We do need vitamin D, and certainly being out in the sun should not be regarded as something that's bad. I love these forest kindergartens that Aaron is pushing. They've been doing these in Europe for 20 years, including places like Scandinavia. And the philosophy is there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing. And I think that that's a terrific way of doing it.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Kids, they're playing tag outside. We're talking this hour about children and nature, how those two drifted apart, how to get them back together in our age of inside all the time childhood. Scott Sampson is with us. He's a dinosaur paleontologist. You may know him from his PBS show, Dinosaur Train. He's chief curator at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. He's out with a new book called How to Raise a Wild Child. And he means that in the most admiring way, the art and science of falling in love with nature. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And Aaron Kenney is with us, co-founder, director of the Cedar Song Nature School on Vashon Island, across the water there from Seattle in Washington State, where the kids spend 2, 3, 4, 5 hours a day, their time at school, preschool, outside. She's author of Forest Kindergartens, The Cedar Song Way. Aaron, Scott, stand by. We've got a lot of callers here. Ponca City, Oklahoma. Rob is calling. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was raised as a free-range child, and my mom would be arrested for what she allowed us kids to do when I was a kid. I'm 57. One of the problems today, my wife is a principal, and there's so much, we're such a litigious society that, she's afraid to have kids go out when it's too cold. She's afraid to have them go out when it's too hot. If it's raining or, the weather's not perfect, then they can't go out even to recess anymore.
Well, I mean, there are times, we know a bunch of Oklahoma, it's a pretty rough weather in the last 24 hours. There are times, but still, just how picky we can be these days sometimes. Rob, I appreciate your call. Aaron Kenney, how do you deal with that? Do you have parents sign papers saying my kid can go outside and fall off a log and it's okay, whatever the weather, before they even join up?
Well, actually, Tom, that is a consideration in any all-outdoor program in the United States. We are an extremely litigious society, and it is not as true in Europe. And so quite often in Europe, if a child gets injured in an outdoor program, the parents are more likely to take the attitude that, well, their kid's playing outside, that they're going to get cut and scraped.
Yeah. Also, even in Washington State, you have winter. You have very rainy days and plenty of them. How do you keep your kids outside for hours at a time and have them be warm and healthy?
Well, as Scott mentioned, the primary thing is the clothing. We have specific clothing that the children are required to come dressed in. And if the parents can't afford that clothing, we will buy it for them. It's that important. We are set up as a nonprofit so that we can offer financial assistance for things like clothing so that the parents are able to have their kids warm and dry no matter what the weather. Children don't care if it's raining. If the parents have sent them to school with a positive message about how much fun they're going to have in the rain, children take their cues from their adult mentors, and all of our teachers are excited to be outside in the rain. There are myriad ways that children play and engage in rain and learn about water flow and the cycle of water. There are many important natural science lessons in a heavy rain day, and truthfully, that's some of our most fun days for the children.
I can believe that. I mean, I want to put this question to Scott as well, but let me ask you first. Somehow I'm picturing on your lovely island idol there a lot of affluent white kids. What about the economics of this, Aaron? Do you get the full spectrum participation from the very, very wide spectrum now of American incomes and income levels?
Well, that is a problem, specifically for our location. Living on Vashon Island, parents take a ferry to bring their kids to our program, and so that's an added cost. Also, since our program only runs up to five hours a day, parents who are working full-time or have to have a couple of jobs to make ends meet are not going to be able to maybe enroll their child full-time in our program. They can choose one day a week or whatever fits into their schedule. We also, as a nonprofit, we also offer financial assistance for anyone who can't afford it. But access is a real issue, and one of the things that is driving this movement is wanting to get this ideology into the public schools and more urban areas where we can demonstrate that connecting with nature, as Scott said, is not about going out into a national forest. It's about going outdoors every day and finding nature where you can find it. Even rain falling on pavement is nature, and there's a lesson there. And it's about how you connect children with nature, not in a top-down, heavy-handed, dystopian way, but rather an authentic connection through the awe and wonder that is reflected and modeled by their adult mentors.
Got a lot of response online here. Bill says national park season is approaching. Spectacular opportunities. Can see three national parks from Seattle. They're all over. Lucky Bill there. Whitney says, my brother and I have talked about how it seems we were the last generation of free-range children. Freddie says, my 8-year-old just wrote a paper asking for more than 20 minutes recess. Even kids, Freddie writes, realize they need to be outside more. Scott Sampson, what about this economics issue, the economics of nature access and connection? If you've got parents who are working multiple jobs, if they're not in easy economic circumstances, and most are not, then what? Make a difference?
Yeah, one of the greatest problems of the Children in Nature movement at this moment is that it's largely a white affluent movement. And one of the reasons for writing this book and for working on these things at the urban level is thinking about how we might scale it so it becomes a movement that embraces all kids. All kids deserve this right. And there are organizations doing tremendous things. In the very low-income community of Montbello in northwest Denver, there's a woman named Stacy Gilmore who runs Environmental Learning for Kids. And she takes youth, mostly Black and Latino youth, who are contemplating careers in gangs, and instead gives them another community that they can connect with, and they get exposed to nature. They do service learning in their communities and in nearby state and national parks. And Stacy has been recognized by the White House for her work. So there are organizations doing tremendous work to take Black and Latino and other minority children and really connect them with nature. But we need a lot more of this, and I think it's going to require collaboration at the urban level. Every single city today has dozens of organizations that are connecting kids with nature, but we're still not moving the needle at the city scale, and I think it's through collaboration that we can do that.
Let me go to Adrian in Buffalo, New York. Adrian, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do a lot of wellness advocacy for our district, the Buffalo Public School District, and we are constantly fighting for things like more physical activity and more recess. And I think that, it's a problem in that, number one, we always hear that there isn't enough funding for this. And it's also something that we see, it's the first thing that's taken away from the kids. They're punished by not having recess. They say, there's just not enough time in the day to allow the kids to partake in these things. And I mean, what I feel is that, there just needs to be a complete paradigm shift. Common Core is on everybody's focus. But you know what? These kids aren't performing well because they're not getting that physical activity component. They're not getting outside. And we need to have that shift to focus on the whole child so that they can perform well. And so we're not having incidents of aggression in the classroom and everything else. These kids, they need that physical activity. And it should never, ever have anything punitive hanging over it. And there are studies out there that show that kids, their success in the classroom, their performance improves when they have this outdoor time. And, I mean, I'm living in Buffalo, New York. It's snowing here right now. I have heard from my daughter's teachers numerous times this year that they couldn't go out for all sorts of different reasons, and it's very complicated. And I don't see what's so complicated about getting your kids out there. It just has to be a complete paradigm shift.
Adrian, I promise we'll look at the school issue, but let me ask you, you've got a daughter or daughters. What, outside of school, are you willing to act on this on your own? Are you willing to let them be out and be playing, maybe autonomously, maybe outside your supervision? Or are you like so many American parents today, like, no, come on home. I have to know where you are. I don't know.
And that's an interesting question because I do live in an urban setting.
Yeah.
I used to work out or play outside regularly when I was a little kid. I do feel a certain sort of caution. I allow my girls to walk in a group to the park, which is very close to our house. I'm all about them being outside all the time.
Yep.
But do I still have a little bit of that level of caution because of I am sort of influenced by, our environment. And I'm, that is tricky. However, again, I instead, say, go ahead, go out as a group. it's just so important to be out there. And, I mean, they're always outside in my front and backyard.
Adrienne, we got it, and I appreciate your call so much. Scott Sampson, what about school versus family and home when it comes to responsibility for getting kids into nature? How do you see that?
I think it's a dual responsibility. Parents need to change their habits, and so do teachers and administrators. There is this trend in the country to extend the school day, to limit lunch hour, to limit or remove recess. And if we look at countries that have higher rated education systems, countries like Finland, they're going the opposite direction. Not only do they have longer lunches and recess, they sometimes have 15 minutes between classes because they recognize that kids aren't going to be able to concentrate unless they burn off some of that energy, unless they are able to relax and reset. So I think schools have a role to do this. And one way of doing it is by using the schoolyard. Sharon Danks in San Francisco and others are doing these great works with living schoolyards, turning the schoolyard into an ecosystem with gardens, with outdoor classrooms, with native plants, so that a lot of the schooling actually occurs outdoors, whether it's science or social studies or English or art.
And we know, Aaron, you do a lot of that. Scott, here I am putting Adrienne in Buffalo on the spot about her own parenting. You make an interesting distinction here between, we hear a lot about helicopter parenting, hovering parents, never giving their children freedom. You recommend what you call hummingbird parenting. What's that?
Yeah, it's a great idea, and it's not mine. There's a wonderful woman who wrote a blog about this, and basically what she said is, listen, instead of this hovering kind of parenting, act more like a hummingbird, where you stay on the periphery, you zoom in when needed, and then you zoom back to the periphery. And as your kids get older, practice giving them greater and greater space. Kids need that autonomy. And I think that's a wonderful metaphor for all of us to keep in mind when we're with our kids. Let them play and engage and climb trees and do all these things, and give them the space to do that. Support them in doing it, and only zoom in when we're needed.
Marcio in Somerville, Massachusetts. Marcio, you're on the air.
Okay, Dom.
Hi.
And my point is, as one of your guests just mentioned, the parents have a major role to play in taking kids out to play outdoors. Because if the weather is nice, there is a park nearby, but the mother or the father or both does not want to go there and interact with their son or daughter, nothing will happen.
Yeah.
So the parents must be engaged and to know what it means to have the kids playing outside, playing with toys that enhance their ability to make decisions, to develop their imagination, problem solving.
Yeah, it sounds pretty easy, but is it easy, Marcio?
It is not, because sometimes the parents have two jobs and they don't have the time. But, however, nothing in this life is easy. So the parents should dedicate and arrange a time so their kids can have that quality time that they deserve.
Marcio, our time grows short, and I appreciate your call very much. Aaron Kenny, thank you, Marcio. Aaron, can parents do what you do? I mean, here you have kids in preschool, and you have them out there a lot. You give them a lot of autonomy. Is there any reason that parents can't do the same?
Well, yes and no, Tom. I think that it is true that we live in a culture that is just very busy all the time and overscheduled. And so parents may be thinking, well, I'm scheduling one more thing, you know, in nature. But really it's as easy as just stepping outside your door. And one of the things we try to empower parents to understand is that it's not about going out and doing activities in nature with your child. It's about just going out and being with your child in nature and following their lead, seeing what excites them and where their curiosity lies, and then reflecting back that awe and wonder about the natural world that supports their child's excitement about learning.
Scott, your big point here, yes, it's child by child and important for each one's development, but you make a very big case that the future of nature depends on this too, not just our children.
Yeah. Every generation makes the decision about preserving public lands, state parks, national parks, etc. And if kids aren't connecting with nature, where they live, why are they going to protect these places when they grow up? And believe me, the parks folks are worried about this. The Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, their members are aging out and they're not being replaced. And we know that conservation will depend on having a generation that cares about the natural world. So connecting kids with nature is an issue not just for the health of kids, but for the health of where they live.
Could we really raise a generation that just didn't care? Just give me my screen and nature schmature.
Well, it's even more dangerous than that because, I mean, Richard Louv called it last child in the woods. And if we're raising this generation that has no contact with the natural world, when they have kids, they're not going to value the natural world. And so we will have severed the bond between humans and nature. And that's a very dangerous thing to move forward with.
We do not have to do that, Scott Sampson writes. And he says it's not that hard. His new book is How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Aaron Kenny at Vashon Island at the Cedarsong Nature School, author of Forest Kindergartens. Aaron, good luck to you, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Scott, you've got wild children on all our minds now, and we're grateful for that. It's kind of a happy thing to contemplate. Let's go toward it. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure being on the show.
Scott Sampson, dinosaur paleontologist and chief curator at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.